Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 141A, An Alternative History of Heresy in Europe by David Ford. I hope you're well, everyone. I am, of course, missing you terribly and absolutely hating being on holiday.
Yuck. Ah, horrid.
But while I have to say I think I'll pull through, I'm eager to get back to podcasting, which I'm sure I'll do before March, if any of you are still around to listen. But today, I'm speaking to somebody else's script, to David Ford's script. David has been listening to the History of England since pretty early on, I think, through the days of my early incompetence to the days of my more recent incompetence. So when he wrote and said there were things about my heresy episode he didn't necessarily agree with, as you can imagine, I wanted to know more. And this episode is the result, and I'm as pleased as punch to have been rubbish enough to spark dispute. And an episode about heresy seems awfully appropriate for a Christmas episode, don't you think? So the voice is mine, the words belong not to me, but to David. Except at the end, where I have some thank yous. Since my Christmas joy and delight, I appear to still have donators, despite my lack of output. Anywho, here we go. On to David Ford. Intellectuals are interesting critters. They chatter away using words that most of us don't know, apparently talking only to each other. Yet somehow their ideas trickle down to the rest of us over time, and even become what everyone knows about a particular subject. Christianity has been a target for leading Western intellectuals for several centuries now, and they haven't always been fair about the way they've gone about this targeting. They've used ridicule, caricature, and scare tactics. But this is what commonly happens when a new faith seeks to replace a previous one, the new faith in this case being scientific materialism. One of the most frequent of the scare tactics they've used is to present the church as a bloodthirsty tyranny, demanding unthinking conformity and punishing everyone who does not comply with burning. What I'd like to present to you here is an alternative view of the story of heresy and the church's reaction to it over the past two millennia. To begin at the beginning. The first heretic in the history of Christianity was arguably Christ himself. That's what got him crucified. The political religious establishments of Israel and Rome were not prepared to accept some of his claims or some of his teaching, in fact found them dangerous enough to warrant his execution. The next group of Christian heretics are now usually called martyrs. And of course the religion they were at odds with was not Christianity, but classical paganism. Edward Gibbon, he of Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, was one of the early anti-Christian intellectuals. One of his contentions was that paganism was much more tolerant than Christianity, and by now many believe this is true. The facts are rather different. Paganism, as practiced by the Romans, was what I call a CEO religion. The head god was rather like a modern CEO, powerful, entitled, needing appeasement. He had a bunch of VP gods reporting to him, each responsible for certain functions. Paganism is a very old religion. Some feel it can be traced back to the original Indo-Europeans, the one who gave almost everyone from the Burmese border to Iceland the origins of the language they speak. Variants of paganism show up among the Celts, the Germanic tribes, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Aryan founders of Hinduism. It's true that when this paganism encountered another faith, it was generally able to deal with it with some equanimity by introducing its gods into its own system. I mean, what CEO ever declined having a few more VPs reporting to him? But anyone who refused to acknowledge its basic structure was not to be tolerated. And that is exactly what the early Christian martyrs did, and why they were made martyrs by the state. Of course, it was not long after Christ's crucifixion before there were significant variations in the Christian faith, and this led to groups disagreeing with each other and calling each other names like heretic. This is not at all surprising. The first reason these differences arose was that the Greeks had an enormous influence on Christianity from its beginnings. You may recall that the New Testament is written in Greek, not the Aramaic that Christ and his disciples spoke. and Christ spent most of his time in Roman towns where Greek was the common language. Now, the Greeks were a unique people. The fundamental reason why they became the founders of Western thought was that they developed a technique for getting at and passing on the truth that was quite unique. They argued with each other. Virtually everyone else, including the Jews, used a guru-disciple model, with one all-knowing individual passing down the word to students. So when the Greeks took up Christianity, they naturally argued about it. The second reason for differing versions was the huge problem the early Christians were dealing with. The average god in history was a powerful figure, as I said, a CEO or VP type, definitely part of the elite. Yet here was a person being presented as God, who was about as different from this model as it was possible to imagine, a duly convicted criminal, possibly illegitimate, a peasant, known for hanging out with, shall we say, the marginal people of society, and a man who died a horrible death, in short, a real loser. Surely you can't be serious. It took literally centuries of arguing to come up with any agreement on what exactly this Jesus was. All God, all human until promoted by God, all human, and other variations. Some could never agree, which is why we have very ancient branches of the church that are not orthodox. Some of these branches of the church were huge. In fact, it's been contended that up until a 12th century Muslim crackdown, the church's demographic centre was Baghdad. The people who came up with the best answer to the puzzling nature of God, as far as the West was concerned, lived in the Byzantine Empire, or as they called it, the Roman Empire, in the 4th century. It was they who put the final form on that peculiar Christian doctrine of the Trinity, one God, incomprehensible, uncreated, but presenting three personae or representations to us. The transcendent creator, the ubiquitous, omnipresent spirit, and the personal Jesus. At that time, the Roman Church were country bumpkins. They couldn't even participate in the argument because they lacked the necessary mental equipment or language. For instance, they confused the concept personae with persons, a father, a son, and a Holy Ghost, whatever that was. This impoverished view has led to difficulty ever since, as God has been created by Western Christians as much too human. Hey, since he wasn't created, he couldn't be vegetable, animal, or mineral, or a person, a place, or a thing, could he? The Roman Church did what people often do when they don't understand something. They mocked it. They thought all these goings on in Constantinople were just foolishness. And our friends, the hostile intellectuals, accepted this gift and continued the tradition. One of the fascinating things about the study of history for me is that it gives me a chance to try to get into the heads of people who are both like me and more different from me than I can possibly understand. Partly this difference comes about because I know things that they don't. The gradual conversion to Christianity of the citizens of the Roman Empire is something we all know about. And so it doesn't seem at all strange to us. But think about it. A religion that has been around for millennia over a good portion of the earth, which fitted in very nicely to the structure of society, and more, as Christian influence wanes, would fit very nicely today, replaced by the cult of a loser. It's been called the only true revolution in recorded history. And it gets even weirder than this. Think of trying to sell this wimpy religion to, say, an Anglo-Saxon warlord. I'd like to take this up, should David ever invite me back to write another podcast. How this revolution came about is one of the greatest of all mysteries. For centuries, Christians had an easy explanation. It was supposed to happen. But that doesn't satisfy many people today. We do know that Christianity appealed to the underclasses, the poor, slaves, and women. The early church leaders insisted on complete equality in church and took everyone seriously. Everyone has to be valued because everyone had an immortal soul and God loved them. It's been pointed out that the story of Peter's tears when he disowned Christ three times on the night before his trial is the first written record of a peasant's sorrow being regarded as anything other than a source of amusement. The understanding that compassion should be felt for anyone at all, let alone the underprivileged, was not, shall we say, a major feature of pagan religion. Julian the Apostate, the last pagan Roman emperor, complained bitterly about this Christian charity in a letter to a friend. Not only do they look after their own poor, but ours as well. But the underclass don't get their way unless they resort to overwhelming force. And as I said, the Christians were considered heretics and thus fair game for shows in the arena and other fun. But somehow this didn't discourage them enough. They kept multiplying like rabbits. This must be considered very strange. Eventually, though, someone was bound to figure out that if you have a large part of your citizenry convinced that this new religion is the absolute truth, why not use it? Constantine, the first emperor to be baptized, clearly thought in this way. His idea was to formalize it and make it a way to unify his empire. That's why he called together all the bishops he could find to the first ecumenical council and bullied them into producing the Nicene Creed. They didn't all agree with it, or the need for it, or the need to enforce it, which they mostly didn't, but with the emperor breathing down their necks, they had little choice but to endorse it. Thus began the tension-fraught dance of the political and Christian leaders that went on for the next several centuries. The Emperor Theodosius experienced the downsides of letting the church in soon enough after Constantine. He ordered the usual sort of response to some unruly behaviour on the part of some of his subjects in Thessalonica in the year 390. They rioted and killed the imperial governor and his assistants. Theodosius's troops rounded them up and slaughtered 7,000 of them in the local hippodrome. For this, Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, ordered Theodosius to do public penance, and after some weeks, he gave in and did it. How humiliating! Theodosius and his successors also found themselves enacting laws to protect the rights of women, make the manumission of slaves easier and the treatment of slaves more humane. Heresy was surprisingly rare in the West through most of the earlier centuries, particularly after a settlement was reached on the question of the nature of Christ at another great council of bishops, this one held in Chalcedon. While certain church authorities did call in the state to punish those they disagreed with from the earliest days of gaining official status, this was by and large directed at the leadership, not at followers. Why was heresy such a small problem in the Middle Ages? The hostile intellectuals would have it that it was because a tightly organized church kept everyone under its thumb, using fear of hell and other threats. Then it must be said that hellfire was definitely part of the Christian world. But another plausible explanation is that Christianity actually suited all levels of society quite well, particularly when judiciously blended with borrowings from the old agrarian folk religion. They found it gave structure, meaning, and consolation in an otherwise difficult existence. It might even be argued that they were happier in this than many people today. Further evidence that this second explanation might be more correct is the fact that the church had less power than it was later thought to have. The overlapping and two-way loyalties characteristic of the feudal system, and the will to power that one always finds at the top of all political structures, made certain this was the case, as did the very poor communications of the era and general lack of education, even among the clergy. The first major event of mass persecution of heretics by the church was in the year 1208, when Innocent III endorsed the French crusade against the much-to-be-pitied Cathar sect. But there is more to be told about this grisly episode than one normally hears. Innocent treated the Cathars, whose profoundly dualistic views were very much against Christian teaching, with considerable gentleness at first, merely sending preachers to help them see the light. And they did believe the world was the creation of the devil, an idea that many today would find very unattractive. But then they had the misfortune to be chosen as a political weapon by some of the local lords who used their conversion to the new faith as an excuse to murder priests, seize church property, and burn monasteries. It was only when this violence appeared to be getting well out of hand that Innocent decided to support the lords of northern France, who used the opportunity to despoil the lords of the south. The generally stable situation all began to change in the 14th and 15th centuries. Why? A large part of the reason may have been the coming of the Black Death. This was such a horrible experience that it must have left the survivors with the mother of all post-traumatic stress disorders. I don't think any of us can imagine what it would be like living in a time when the population of England, for example, went from around 7 million down to 2.5. Much that was considered certain about the world had proved false. Another source of disruption was the flow of classical learning and Greek classical scholars from the Christian East after the fall of Constantinople to the Muslims in 1453. Modern scholarship, by the way, has shown that the Christians had respected and preserved classical learning from the earliest days. A third, and possibly the most powerful, disruptive influence was the beginning of the rise of the modern nation-state. Local CEOs were tired of sharing power with anyone. And of course there was the state of the church itself. Because the church was a corporation, not a family, it accumulated wealth over the generations. Every gift of land and other capital made by the pious stayed with it, instead of being dispersed through the normal process of inheritance. And some of the monasteries were remarkably successful business enterprises, owing, probably, to the high concentration of the ablest men of the age in such places. And then there was the tithe, authorised by no less an authority than the Bible. Places with power naturally attract CEO types who, as I've said, generally have a very strong sense of personal entitlement. Church leaders generally came from the same families that supplied the secular leadership. All this led to a church being much too focused on earthly things and a target for those who felt its wealth ought to be shared with others, notably themselves. It must be said, though, that even at its worst, the church did continue to provide a significant amount of charity. One of the consequences of Henry's shutdown of the monasteries in England was the more or less complete destruction of the social safety net. People were reduced to learning to act crazy so they could get into the hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem, otherwise known as Bedlam. The result of all of this was the Reformation, but even Martin Luther didn't actually want to break away from the Roman Church when he began, he just wanted to reform it. He wouldn't have succeeded if he'd not had the protection of various local princes who saw his cause as a route to achieving more independence. As for Henry VIII in England, everyone knows he just wanted to get remarried and of course fill his treasury and reward some good friends. After all, not long before he decided to form the Anglican Church, he'd been given the title Defender of the Faith by the Pope. One effect of the Reformation was to fan the flames of the scientific revolution. By making the Bible the sole source of authority and urging all Christians to read it and interpret it for themselves, the Protestant reformers were encouraging individualism and scepticism on a very large scale. While this has generally been considered a great good, it does have its drawbacks. The Bible is a very complex set of books, written over several centuries, during which people's understanding of the nature of God and many other important issues changed a great deal. You really do need to know a lot before you can interpret it properly. Leaving everyone to do their own interpretation was bound to lead to some very inaccurate, weird, and even dangerous ideas. And besides, as far as the church was concerned, the Bible was its document, not the other way around. Its members had written parts of it and edited the rest, even choosing what was to be included from a large amount of candidate material, and deciding what was to be left out. The Book of Revelation, so beloved of a certain strain of Christian today, only just barely made it in. So the church leadership thought it had the right to interpret what it said. The Reformation ushered in the main period of violence towards heretics. The leadership of the nascent nation-states did find Christianity very helpful when dealing with the problem of defining their new realms of absolute power. In general, it's easier to make people fight people who they consider to be different from them, preferably inferior or subhuman. The Nazis used this approach extensively, for example. The now clearly differing varieties of Christianity provided convenient fault lines for this sort of thing, both when dealing with outside enemies and when dealing with dissent within. Protestants, or Catholics if you're on the other side, could be called heretics, and hatred could be whipped up against them. The materialist intellectuals often cite the Inquisition as a powerful example of the Church's new intolerance. and no one could call the Spanish version, at least, anything but nasty. There's also a Roman and a Portuguese Inquisition. But again, there is another side to the story. By far, the main target of the Spanish Inquisition was the so-called conversos, Jews and Muslims who had become Christian by choice or forced choice, rather than be expelled from the country. They were suspected of carrying on their old religious practices and considered a fertile source of subversion. Thus, the Inquisition was almost exclusively an instrument of the new nation-state's power, used by Ferdinand and Isabella and their successors to coerce conformity in their citizenry. They made this very clear to Pope Sixtus IV, when they simply ignored the bull he issued in 1482, denouncing its destruction of innocent lives and theft of property. Modern research has also shown that it wasn't really that deadly. In a review of 44,674 cases, it was found that 826 resulted in execution, a rate of 1.8%. Only about 1,500 people were executed over its entire 50-year history. A modern state can manage this in a few minutes, murdering complete innocents without any tiresome trial procedures. Perhaps the reason why the Inquisition still looms so large as a symbol of evil is that Spain was at war with England during its heyday. It was a convenient focus for the English leadership in its quest to whip up fear and hatred in the populace. You're a Protestant. If they catch you, they'll burn you at the stake. In point of fact, only about a dozen Protestants were ever executed. Every new faith must have its martyrs, and in the case of scientific materialism, the name Galileo comes immediately to mind, presented by intellectuals as a chilling example of the oppression of thought by a tyrannous church. But again, there are facts that are not mentioned often. His persecutor, Urban VIII, was a former patron and friend who treated him with honour and indulgence. At the time, Copernicanism was an unproven and very awkward theory. It didn't really work until Kepler added his discovery that planets' orbits were actually elliptical, an idea that Galileo thought was silly. Yet Galileo, a man of massive ego, demanded blind assent to it, while the church wanted proof. Another problem with the Galileo myth is that it is supposed to represent a consistent church policy. Where are the other examples? On the contrary, the greatest scientists of the early modern age, Descartes, Kepler, Newton, were convinced Christians, as have been many great scientists who'd followed them. Some of the greatest early astronomers were Jesuits. So here we are in the 16th century when the burning of heretics really gets underway. Bloody Mary burns six in my grandfather's village in Sussex alone. I've offered some explanations for why this happened now, but why were the hatred and fanaticism on both sides so strong? Some people were quite prepared to go to the fire for their beliefs, and there can be few more agonising deaths. Why did it matter so much to them whether or not the communion wafer became the actual body of Christ during communion, for example? I don't think we'll ever get into these people's heads enough to really understand, but we can make some conjectures. We mustn't forget how very inexplicable life was then, when nobody knew about germs, no one understood anything about the forces of nature, the mortality rate, particularly amongst children, was very high, and the productivity of the economy meant that most were wanting what one would call bare necessities, and were one bad harvest away from starvation. For more than a millennium, Christianity had provided a bulwark of strongly held faith against all this anxiety. But then the Black Death, the rise of nation-states and accompanying civil unrest, technological change, the new learning, the Reformation all made life very confusing, and the faith began its long process of waning, still going on today. Arthur C. Clarke once said that sufficiently advanced technology is impossible to distinguish from magic, and the beginning of science was very much involved in magic as well. Newton, for example, spent more time on alchemy than he did on physics. The main difference between the world then and the world now is that we have discovered much magic and our magic works. In the process, we've learned that underlying the physical world's huge and apparently incomprehensible complexity is amazing simplicity. Who would have thought that one simple formula would describe the force that brings an apple to Earth and govern the motions of the galaxies? Who would have thought that all life on Earth is based on just 17 elements? Or that there are just 92 naturally occurring elements, period. Thus for us, the world is much more rational and comprehensible than it was for them. In a highly confusing and uncertain world, they desperately needed certainty, so desperately they were willing to die in its name. We, on the other hand, think that because the physical world has turned out to be so comprehensible, all other parts must be too. And we've become very arrogant about this. We even think the whole world will be understood by humans someday, and that if you can't touch, taste, see, smell, or hear something, it doesn't exist. But think about it. The only thing I really know for sure is that I'm me. I can be fooled about anything else, and in fact, I have to take an awful lot of the world on faith. Yet what has science done to explain how this consciousness arose, or what it means? I would say nothing. The truth is, the materialism that has welled up from the scientific world is no more a rational or logical faith than any other, and it's incredibly bleak. Well, there you have it, an alternate view of the heresy in Europe. I realise that many people who are listening to this will have found what I have to say very difficult to believe, but I'm willing to back up anything I've said with references, should you ask. So, in the words of Mike Yarwood, and this is me. Thank you, David. And there we are, everyone. One person's view and a plea in favour of Christianity from David Ford. And I have to say, though I consider myself a kind of secular Protestant and as likely to point the finger at venal popes as anyone, I might reflect that while Billy the Conk was in his pomp, laying about him left, right and centre, the popes at the time were trying to get everyone to agree to an annual period of truce called the Peace of God. Fat chance. Anyway, before finishing, I wanted to take the chance to say thank you to a stream of people who've donated recently. Two: David and Mary from Flatter, to Gary, John, Daniel, Glenn, Robert, Alan, Christopher, John, David, Lisa, Terry, Mike, Michael, Simon, Philip, Jim, Robert, Matthew, Janita, Oak, Mary, Amy, Jim, my mum, and anyone else who knew me. More guest episodes on the way, all, but in the meantime, good luck everyone and have a smashing Christmas.